Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Loris by Eugene Vodolazkin, translated by Lisa C. Hayden, narrated by James Anderson Foster. Prolegomenon. He had four names at various times. A person's life is heterogeneous, so this could be seen as an advantage. Life's parts sometimes have little in common, so little that it might appear various people lived them. When this happens, it is difficult not to feel surprised that all these people carry the same name. He also had two nicknames, one of them, Rukinets, referred to Rukino Quarter, where he came into the world. But this person was known to most people by the nickname Doctor, because he was, more than anything, a doctor to his contemporaries. He was, one should think, something more than a doctor, because what he achieved went beyond the limits of a doctor's possibilities. It is thought that the word vrach for medical doctor comes from the word vrati, which means to say an incantation. This similarity supposes that words as such, no matter what they meant, played an essential role in the medical treatment process. The role of words was more significant during the Middle Ages than it is now, because of the limited selection of medications. So speaking a lot was a necessity. Doctors spoke. They knew certain methods for treating ailments, but they did not pass up opportunities to address disease directly. Uttering rhythmic phrases that outwardly lacked meaning, they said an incantation over the illness, smoothly convincing it to abandon the patient's body. The line between doctor and medicine man was relative during this period. Patients spoke. In the absence of diagnostic technology, patients needed to describe in detail everything occurring within their ailing bodies. Sometimes they thought the illness left them, bit by bit, along with their unhurried, pain-steeped words. They could speak only with their doctors about all the details of their illnesses, and this made them feel better. The patient's relatives spoke. They clarified their loved one's statements or even amended them because not all illnesses permitted the sufferers to give reliable reports of what they had gone through. Relatives could openly express concerns that the illness was untreatable and complain, the Middle Ages was not a sentimental time, that it is difficult to deal with an ill person. This made them feel better, too. The defining trait of the person under discussion is that he spoke very little. He remembered the words of Arsenius the Great. I have often regretted the things I have said, but I have never regretted my silence. Most often, he looked wordlessly at the patient. He might say only, your body will still serve you, or your body has become unsuitable. Prepare to leave it. Know that this shell is imperfect. His renown was great. It spread throughout the entire inhabited world. He could not avoid notice anywhere. His appearances drew together many people. He would cast an attentive gaze upon those present, his wordlessness transferring itself to those who had gathered. The crowd froze in place, only small clouds of steam instead of words left hundreds of open mouths, and he would watch how they melted in the frosty air. And the crunch of January snow under his feet was audible, or the rustle of September foliage. Everyone awaited a miracle, and the sweat of expectation rolled down the faces of those in attendance. Salty drops fell, resonating on the earth. The crowd parted, letting him through to the person he had come to see. He would place his hand on the patient's forehead or touch wounds. Many believed that the touch of his hand could heal, and thus the nickname Rukinets, given to him because of his place of birth, but rooted in the word ruka, for hand, acquired additional meaning. His doctoring skills were honed over the years, reaching at the zenith of his life heights that seemed unattainable for a human being. It was said that he possessed the elixir of immortality. It is even said from time to time that this giving healer could not die as all other people do. The basis for this opinion is that his body had no traces of decay after death, maintaining its former appearance after lying under an open sky for many days. and then it disappeared, as if its possessor had grown tired of lying there. He stood up and left. Those who think this, however, forget that only two people have left the earth in flesh and blood since the creation of the world. Enoch was taken by the Lord at the revealment of the Antichrist, and Elijah was raised to the heavens in a chariot of fire. Holy tradition does not mention a Russian doctor. Judging from his infrequent statements, he did not intend to reside in a body forever, if only because he had worked with bodies his entire life. Most likely, he didn't have the elixir of immortality either. Somehow, things of this sort don't fit with what we know about him. In other words, one can say with certainty that he is not with us at present. It is worth adding, however, that he himself did not always understand what time ought to be considered the present. The Book of Cognition. 1. He came into the world in the Rukina quarter by the Kirillo-Belozersky Monastery. This occurred on May 8th of the 6,948th year since the creation of the world, the 1,440th since the birth of our Savior Jesus Christ, on the feast day of Arsenius the Great. 7 days later he was baptized with the name Arseni. To prepare the newborn for his first communion, his mother did not eat meat for those 7 days. In expectation of the cleansing of her flesh, she did not go to church until the 40th day after his birth. After her flesh had been cleansed, she went to an early service. She prostrated herself in the church vestibule and lay there for several hours, requesting but one thing for her baby: life. Arseni was her third child. Those born previously had not lived out their first year. Arseni survived. On May 8th of the year 1441, the family held a service of thanksgiving at the Kirillov Monastery. After respectfully kissing the relics of the venerable Kirill, Arseni and his parents set off for home, and Christopher, his grandfather, remained at the monastery. The seventh decade of his years would end the next day, and he had decided to ask Nicander, the elder, what to do next. "In principle," replied the elder, "I have nothing to tell you. Just this: live, O friend, close to the cemetery. You are so gangly that it would be difficult to carry you there. And there's this, too: live alone." That is what the elder monk Nicander said. 2. And so Christopher moved close to one of the nearby cemeteries. He found an empty log house some distance from Rukina Quarter, right next to the cemetery fence. The house's masters had not survived the last pestilence. These were years when there were more houses than people. Nobody could bring themselves to settle in this sturdy and spacious but airless house, particularly next to a cemetery filled with the plague dead. But Christopher brought himself to do so. It was said that even then he pictured the further fate of that place quite distinctly, that even at that remote time he allegedly knew that in 1495 a cemetery church would be constructed on the site of his log house. The church was built in gratitude for the favorable conclusion of the year 1492, the 7,000th year since the creation of the world. The anticipated end of the world did not come to pass that year, but Christopher's namesake did discover America, though nobody paid any attention to this at the time, unexpectedly for himself and others. The church is destroyed by the Poles in 1609. The cemetery falls into neglect, and a pine forest grows in its place. Apparitions chat up mushroom pickers from time to time. In 1817, the merchant Kozlov acquires the forest to produce lumber. 2 years later, a charity hospital is built on the cleared site. Exactly 100 years later, the district secret police move into the hospital building. In keeping with the property's initial purpose, that institution organizes mass burials there. In 1942, the German pilot Heinrich von Einsiedel wipes the building off the face of the earth with a well-aimed hit. In 1947, the plot of land is retooled as a military proving ground and transferred to the 7th Tank Brigade of the Order of the Red Banner, named for Kliment Voroshilov. The land has belonged to the White Knights Gardening Association since 1991. The group's members unearth large quantities of bones and missile shells along with potatoes, but they are in no rush to complain to the local authorities. They know nobody would grant them other land anyway. It fell to us to live on land like this, they say. This detailed vision indicated to Christopher that the land would stay untouched in his lifetime, and his chosen home would remain intact for 54 years. Christopher understood that 54 years was considerable for a country with a turbulent history. It was a 5-wall house. In addition to the 4 outer walls, its log framework had a 5th interior wall. Partitioning the framework formed 2 rooms, one warm with a stove, the other cold. When he took up residence in the house, Christopher checked for cracks between the logs and replaced the bull's bladder that was stretched over the windows. He took oily beans and juniper berries and mixed them with juniper chips and frankincense. He added oak leaves and leaves of rue, ground it finely, placed it upon coals, and worked to fill the house with smoke all day long. Christopher did not consider this precaution excessive, despite knowing the pestilence left houses on its own over time. He was afraid for the relatives who might visit him. He was also afraid for those he treated, because they were constantly in his house. Christopher was an herbalist, and all sorts of people came to see him. People came with torturous coughs. He gave them ground wheat with barley flour that he mixed with honey. Sometimes some boiled farro, too, because farro draws moisture from the lungs. Depending on the type of cough, he might give pea soup or water from boiled turnips. Christopher differentiated coughs by sound. If the cough was indistinct and didn't lend itself to definition, Christopher pressed his ear to the patient's chest and listened to his breathing for a long time. People came for wart removal. Christopher ordered them to apply ground onion with salt to the warts, or rub them with sparrow droppings mashed with saliva. He thought ground cornflower seeds, which were to be sprinkled on the warts, was the best method of treatment, though. The cornflower seeds drew the root from the warts, so they would never grow on that place again. Christopher also helped with bedroom matters. He immediately identified visitors with these concerns based on how they entered and hesitated at the door. Their tragic and guilty gaze amused Christopher, but he did not let that show. Without ceremony, he called upon them to remove their pants, and the guests silently complied. Sometimes he sent them to wash in the next room, recommending they pay particular attention to the foreskin. He was convinced the rules of personal hygiene should be upheld, even in the Middle Ages. He listened, irritated, to the unsteady flow of water from the dipper into the wooden tub. "What wilt thou say of this, then?" he wrote on a piece of birch bark in a fit of temper. "And how can it be that women let men like this near them? What a nightmare!" If the secretive member had no obvious damage, Christopher inquired about the problem in detail. They knew he was discreet, so were not afraid to tell him. If there was no erection, Christopher suggested supplementing meals with expensive anise and almond or an inexpensive mint syrup. All increase the seed and promote bedroom thoughts. The same effect was attributed to the plant with the unusual name of livelong, as well as to simple wheat. Finally, there was also hare's ear, which had 2 roots, white and black. An erection would arise from using white, but vanish with black. The drawback to this method was that the white root had to be held in the mouth at the crucial moment. Not everyone was willing to do that. If all that did not increase the seed and promote bedroom thoughts, the herbalist moved from the plant world to the animal world. Those who had lost their potency were advised to eat cockerel kidneys or duck. In critical situations, Christopher gave orders to obtain fox balls, grind them in a mortar, and drink them with wine. For those not up to that task, he proposed eating ordinary hen's eggs while alternately taking bites of onion and turnip. Christopher did not exactly believe in herbs. More likely, he believed God's help would come through any herb for a specific matter, just as that help comes through people. Both are but instruments. He did not ponder why each of the herbs he knew was associated with strictly defined qualities. He considered that question frivolous. Christopher understood who had established that association, and that was all he needed to know. Christopher's help to his fellow man was not limited to medicine. He was convinced the mysterious effects of herbs spread through all aspects of human life. It was known to Christopher that the plant sow thistle, its roots as light as wax, brought success. He gave it to commercial traders so they would be received with honor and rise to great glory wherever they might go. "Only be not proud beyond means," Christopher warned them, "for pride is the root of all sin." He gave sow thistle only to those of whom he was absolutely certain. More than anything, Christopher loved a red plant known as the Tsar's Eyes, or round-leaved sundew, that was about the height of a needle. He always had it with him. He knew it was good to have some on his person when beginning any matter. Bring it to court, for example, so as not to be convicted, or sit at a banquet with it and fear not the heretic lying in wait for anyone who lets his guard down. Christopher did not like heretics. He recognized them using Adam's head, also known as mandrake. When gathering this plant near marshes, he blessed himself with the sign of the cross and the words, "Have mercy upon me, O God." After that, Christopher gave the plant to a priest for sanctification, asking that it be laid on the altar and kept there for 40 days. When he carried it after the 40 days had elapsed, he was able to guess unfailingly who was a heretic or a demon, even in a crowd. For jealous spouses, Christopher recommended duckweed, though not the duckweed that covers marshes, but the dark blue plant that spreads on land. It should be placed at the head of the bed by the wife. When she falls asleep, she will tell everything about herself on her own, the good and the bad. There was another method, too, for compelling her to start talking. Owl heart. It was supposed to be applied to a sleeping woman's heart. Few people took that step, though. It was frightening. Christopher himself had no need for these remedies because his wife had died 30 years before. They had been caught in a thunderstorm while gathering plants, and she was killed by lightning at the edge of the forest. Christopher had stood, unable to believe his wife was dead. She had just been alive. He shook her by the shoulders, and her wet hair streamed along his hands. He rubbed her cheeks. Her lips stirred silently under his fingers. Her wide open eyes looked at the tops of the pine trees. He urged his wife to stand and come back home. She was silent, and nothing could force her to speak. On the day he moved to his new place, Christopher took a medium-sized piece of birch bark and wrote, "After all, they are already adults. After all, their child is already 1 year old. I am of the opinion they will be better off without me." After thinking a bit, Christopher added, "Most important, this is what the elder advised." 3. They began taking Arsini to see Christopher after he turned 2. Sometimes they would leave with the child after a meal. More often, though, they would let Arsini stay for a few days. He liked being at his grandfather's. Those visits turned out to be Arsini's first memories. They were also destined to be the last thing he forgot. Arsini loved the smell in his grandfather's house. The smell was composed of the aromas of the multitude of herbs drying under the ceiling, and that smell did not exist anywhere else. Arsini also loved the peacock feathers a pilgrim had brought to Christopher. They were fanned out on the wall, and the design on the feathers was surprisingly similar to an eye. When the boy was at Christopher's, he felt he was somehow under observation. He also liked the icon of the martyr Saint Christopher, which hung under the Savior's image. It looked unusual amongst the stern Russian icons. Saint Christopher had the head of a dog. The child examined the icon for hours, and his grandfather's features, little by little, began showing through the touching figure of the cynocephalus. Shaggy brows, wrinkles extending from the nose, a beard that began at the eyes. His grandfather dissolved into nature even more readily because he spent most of his time in the forest. He began resembling dogs and bears, and plants and stumps. He spoke in a creaky, wooden voice. Sometimes Christopher took the icon from the wall and gave it to Arsini to kiss. The child thoughtfully kissed St. Christopher on his shaggy head and touched the dulled paints with the pads of his fingers. His grandfather observed the icon's mysterious current flow into Orsini's hands. One time, he made the following note. The child has a special awareness. His future presents itself to me as outstanding, but I have difficulty foreseeing it. Christopher began teaching the boy about herbal treatments at the age of 4. They wandered the forests from morning till night, gathering various plants. They searched for the pheasant's eye plant near ravines. Christopher showed Orsini its sharp little leaves. Pheasant's eye helped with hernia and fever. When this plant was given for fever, along with cloves, sweat would begin streaming off the patient. If the sweat was thick and gave off a strong and nasty odor, it was necessary, Christopher stopped short, looking at Orsini, to prepare for death. The boy's unchildish gaze made Christopher feel ill at ease. What is death? Asked Orsini. Death is when people are silent and do not move. Like this? Orsini sprawled on the moss and looked at Christopher, not blinking. As he lifted the boy, Christopher said inside, My wife, his grandmother, was lying exactly like that, and that is why I was very frightened just now. There is no reason to be afraid, shouted the boy, because I am alive again. On one of their walks, Orsini asked Christopher where his grandmother now dwelled. In heaven, answered Christopher. That same day, Orsini decided to fly to the heavens. The heavens had long appealed to him, and the attraction became irresistible after this announcement that his grandmother, whom he had never seen, dwelled there. Only the peacock feathers, from a bird most certainly of paradise, could help him with this. Upon returning home, Orsini got a rope from the entry room, took the peacock feathers from the wall, and used a ladder to climb onto the roof. He divided the feathers into 2 equal bunches and firmly tied them to his arms. Orsini was planning a short trip to the heavens this first time. He wanted only to inhale its azure air and, if things worked out, finally see his grandmother. He could also say hello to her from Christopher while he was at it. As Orsini imagined things, he could easily return in time for supper, which Christopher just happened to be preparing. Orsini went up to the roof ridge, flapped his wings, and took a step forward. His flight was rapid, but brief. Orsini felt sharp pain in his right foot, the first to touch the ground. He could not stand, and so lay silently, stretching his leg under his wings. Christopher noticed the broken peacock wings beating at the earth when he went outside to call the boy to supper. Christopher felt Orsini's foot and knew it was fractured. He applied a plaster with ground peas to the injured place so the bone would knit together quickly. He bound a small strip of wood to the leg so it could have some rest. He took Orsini to the monastery so his spirit would strengthen along with his flesh. I know you are planning to go to heaven, said Elder Nicander as soon as he saw Orsini. Forgive me, but I think your course of action is outlandish. When the time comes, I will tell you how it is done. They began gathering plants as soon as Orsini was able to put weight on the foot. At first, they walked only in the nearby forest. Then they would go further and further each day, testing Orsini's strength. Along the banks of rivers and streams, they gathered nymphaea, reddish-yellowish flowers with white leaves, to treat poisoning. Near those same rivers, they found the enchanted river plant. Christopher trained Orsini to recognize it by its yellow flower, round leaves, and white root. Horses and cows were treated with this herb. At the forest's edge, they gathered windflower, which grew only in spring. It should be pulled up on the 9th, 22nd, and 23rd of April. Windflower should be placed under the first log when building a log house. They also went looking for the mysterious Sava. Christopher displayed caution here because encountering this plant carried the threat of muddling the mind. But Christopher crouched down in front of the child. If this plant is placed on a thief's tracks, the thieved item will return. He put the Sava in his basket and covered it with burdock. Along the way home, they always gathered pods from the herb known as river crossing, which repelled snakes. Put a seed in your mouth and water will part, Christopher once said. It will part? Asked Orsini, serious. With prayer, it will part. Christopher began to feel awkward. Everything is about prayer, after all.
Well, then why do you need that seed?
The boy lifted his head and saw Christopher was smiling. That is the legend. It is up to me to tell you this. Once they saw a wolf while they were gathering plants. The wolf was standing a few steps from them, looking them in the eyes. His tongue dangled from his jaw and trembled from panting. The wolf was hot. We will not move, said Christopher, and he will leave. O great martyr Gheorghe, do help.
He will not leave, Arsini objected. He came so he could be with us.
The boy walked up to the wolf and took him by the scruff. The wolf sat. The end of his tail stuck out from under his hind paws. Christopher leaned against a pine tree and attentively watched Arsini. When they headed for home, the wolf set off after them, his tongue still hanging like a little red flag. The wolf stopped at the border of the village. After that, they often ran across the wolf in the forest. The wolf sat beside them when they ate lunch. Christopher tossed him pieces of bread, and the wolf would catch them in the air, his teeth clattering. He stretched out on the grass and pensively stared straight ahead. When the grandfather and grandson returned home, the wolf escorted them right to the house. Sometimes he spent the night in the yard, and the three of them would set out together in the morning to look for plants. When Arsini grew tired, Christopher would sit him in a canvas bag on his back. An instant later, he would feel Arsini's cheek on his neck and understand the boy was sleeping. Christopher stepped gently on the warm summer moss. With the hand not carrying his basket, he straightened the straps on his shoulders and shooed flies away from the sleeping boy. At home, Christopher pulled burrs from Arsini's long hair and sometimes washed his hair with lye. He made the solution from maple leaves and the white herb called enoch, which they gathered together in the low hills. The solution made Arsini's golden hair as soft as silk. It gleamed in the sun. Christopher wove leaves of garden angelica into his hair so people would love him. While he did so, he recognized that people loved Arsini anyway. An appearance from the child cheered people up. All the residents of Rukina Quarter felt it. When they took Arsini by the hand, they did not want to let it go. When they kissed his hair, they felt as if they had drunk from a deep, fresh spring. There was something in Arsini that eased lives that were anything but simple, and people were grateful to him. Before bed, Christopher told the child about Solomon and the centaur. They both knew this story by heart, but always appreciated it as if they were hearing it for the first time. When the centaur was brought to Solomon, he saw a person buying himself boots. The centaur began laughing when the person wanted to know if the boots would last for 7 years. As he walked further, the centaur saw a wedding and began weeping. Solomon asked the centaur why he was laughing. I saw on that person, said the centaur, that live he will not until the 7th day. And Solomon asked the centaur why he was weeping. How sad am I, said the centaur, that live this groom will not until the 30th day. The boy once said, I do not understand why the centaur laughed, because he knew the person would be resurrected? I do not know. I am not sure. Christopher himself also felt it would have been better if the centaur had not laughed. Christopher placed purple loosestrife under Arsini's pillow so he would fall asleep easily, which is why Arsini fell asleep easily, and his dreams were placid. 4. At the start of the second septenary of years in Arsini's life, his father brought the boy to Christopher. Rukina Quarter is restless, said the father. People await the plague scourge. Let the boy stay here, far from everyone. You may stay too, Christopher offered, and your wife. I have, O father, grain to reap. Where will we find food in winter? Arsini's father just shrugged his shoulders. Christopher crushed some hot sulfur and gave it to him so they could drink it later at home with egg yolk, washed down with rosehip juice. He ordered them not to open the windows and to lay a fire with oak logs in the yard every morning and evening. When the coals begin smoldering, toss wormwood, juniper, and rue on them.
That is all. That is all that can be done. Christopher sighed. Guard thyself against this sorrow, O son. Arsini began crying as he watched his father walk to his cart.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?